Right, today I'm joined virtually, not in person, with Mark Phillips, the head of Global Sports Integrity, who's based in Australia. Thanks for agreeing to talk to us, Mark.
You're welcome.
You're in Australia now, but your roots are in Torquay, in Devon, in England. So you tell us a bit about your, about first of all, what Global Sports Integrity does, and then rewind a few years.
Sure. GSI, or Global Sports Integrity, kind of does what it says on tin. We're a global sports integrity company, mainly on the betting side, which is obviously where my experience comes from and why I'm talking to you. But we consult to sports governing bodies, police forces, law firms, anyone who wants advice on sports integrity, basically. We've designed software systems, monitoring programs, database, interrogation, intelligence systems. But one of the main parts is the actual monitoring of betting markets for sports. So we might monitor any particular sport, tournament, season, whatever, and report back to the sports with our findings, whether you give a race or an event the all clear, or whether we recommend that they delve in a little bit deeper. But it's basically independent advice or independent monitoring of sports markets.
And is that largely the exchange markets?
No, it's been more fixed odds, really. We've delved in recently. We designed and developed a tool for monitoring the sort of Asian grey markets. So we've been monitoring all bases, really. We obviously monitor the exchanges closely, but the fixed odds market out here is still pretty strong.
Okay, so we'll talk more about the nitty-gritty of your business in a bit. But so you're now in Australia, but you grew up in Torquay. Can you tell us that you got a bit of a bookmaking background?
I have, yeah. My dad, Dave Phillips, is a bookmaker, still a bookmaker after 50-odd years, so semi-retired now. You'd know my dad. You worked for him for a little while. So I was born into it, really, as a lot of the people on your show have been. My dad started bookmaking around 1970. I was born a couple of years later, so by the time I was a teenager, he was well established in the southwest, and he had 20-25 different pitches around the UK. So from a young age, he was sort of half dragging me racing, really. He'd say to me when I was sort of 10 years old, "Do you want to come racing today?" And I would always reply with the same question, like, "How far is it?" Because I didn't want to spend that much time in a car. So if it was a 3-hour journey in the car, he would say it was 2 and try and get me there. But I would often be sort of seen hanging around the joint at what was Devon and Exeter and Newton Abbot and some of the local points rather than going further afield. And started working for him when I was really young, I suppose, too young to actually be officially allowed to do it anyway, for sure, you know, giving out a bit of change here and there. And then that sort of moved on to being a floor man, running around, checking prices, tic-tacking, you know, that's how old I am. I was a tic-tac man and would read the prices, stood on the joint and relay them back to dad. And then eventually, once I was sort of 18 and was allowed to have a license of my own, I would go and represent him on the race course when he was at another track. And I worked on and off for years for dad, but never actually worked sort of full-time for him. Always was doing something else as well.
So that was the end of the sort of halcyon days of on-course bookmaking, really, before the exchanges and before radios, that sort of thing. What do you sort of, anybody fondly remember, or characters or events back in those early days of your sort of repping?
Yeah, it was full of, as you know, the race course was full of characters back then. Everyone who sort of went regularly was some sort of a character. And I sort of kept myself to myself, really, when I was a youngster. So I didn't get too involved with many of the characters on Racecourse, other than sort of watching them do their business. But Dad always had absolute characters working for him. So, you know, I used to sit there sort of quite quiet in the back, but I always had a couple of guys working for him, Wayne and Edge, who were just such characters. And I remember being, you know, I'd be sort of 15 and Edge would be in the back of the car with his books, and he used to handicap, I think, two mile hurdlers, I think. And he's still doing it. Like 40 years later, he's still doing it. So I sort of got an interest in, you know, there was always such great expectation on the way to the races that Dad just found one and he's got, you know, he's going to have it right off with this one. And it was, you know, it wasn't always so joyful on the way home. And Wayne was a real character who still, you know, he still makes his bit of a living, I think, laying on Betfair, and Dad just still doing his handicaps. And I remember thinking, as a young man, you know, as a teenager, that the way that I wasn't going to have a 9-to-5 job. I don't think that was ever really on my radar. And like Adge and Wayne used to work the summers on the race course. And then the winters, they used to bugger off to India or South Africa or Thailand. And I remember thinking, you know, I think they're doing something right, you know, living life a little bit differently to the norm.
And were there many punters that used to win? Were you sort of aware of, like, professional punters?
Well, yeah, you were always aware of the guys who were turning up day in, day out, betting to 500 and to 1,000 to the fractions, your sort of Eddie the Shoes and Dodgers, and you knew that they must be getting a few quid at the game, unless they, you know, just had a bottomless pit or they, you know, they had the lottery. And you knew from the ones they were backing, they were always backing live ones, that the, you know, the price was gone as soon as they'd start sort of moving around the ring and so on. So it was different to online, you know, they might have a bet on tick, but the pay after the race, you'd pay them out. You never really knocked anyone back. You might half the bet if you don't want the whole bet, but you didn't really have a great idea on exactly how good or how bad they were. So you sort of, you know, you played the price rather than the man, and you basically, if someone wanted a bet, you basically took it.
Now, there was one thing that I noticed from my time working on race courses, that bookmakers' offspring were very prone to getting into deep punting, thinking it was easy. I mean, that I don't think that ever affected you, but some of the staff used to think it was easy and then do their cobblers.
Yeah, definitely. There's definitely been a few stories. For me, I rarely used to have a bet. Dad doesn't have a bet unless he, you know, he's always been the same. He doesn't have a bet unless he thinks he's got an edge. And I'm very much the same. I wouldn't have, I would rarely have a bet when I worked on course. There'd be the odd occasion. I was repping for Dad once in, it was 1996, and it was Royal Ascot. The only reason I was there, because it was my sister was graduating from her medical degree, and it was a big deal in the family. So Dad did the right thing. He went up to London, and I went to Royal Ascot. I remember looking through the card on the way up to Ascot, thinking, God, I quite like one here today. I think I may have found one that looks a bit of value. And it was a Clive Britton train thing called Amphitas or Amfortas. And the reason I liked it, apparently it was stepped up in trip. I think it was 2 furlongs up in trip, lightly raced. It was in the King Edward VII, the mile and a half handicap, or the stakes race. And the reason I liked it was, I remember Clive Britton about 3 months before, whether it was the horse's debut or one of his races, he came on TV and he said, "This is the best horse in my yard." And I remember it and thinking, God, that's the best horse in his yard. It was a case of a little bit of knowledge being dangerous, because I didn't realise, but I found out after that Clive Britton basically thought every horse in his yard was a group horse. And at a couple of years later, I probably would have just brushed it off. But as it happened, it went off 66-1. I tipped it to you know, the guys who were working for me that day pissed in, like one a length and a half or something. So we were all up in the air. We've backed a 66-1 winner. It turned out to be an absolute cracking day. That wasn't the only result. There was skinners all day. And one of the blokes who was working was a guy called Nick, who had only worked a couple of days. I think it was tricky to get staff, you know, for Royal Ascot because everyone's loaded up, but everyone's got all their regular staff on. And I think he must have thought, bloody hell, it's just pretty straightforward. It's pretty easy, you know, 66-1 winners coming out left, right and centre. And we won a few quid and the book won a few quid and didn't hear much about him really for a good while. I spoke to my dad about a year later and apparently got heavily involved and had done his absolute brains. And someone asked him what form book he was using. They didn't even know what a form book was. And that was back in the days when it was an actual thick piece of paper. And people can get the wrong idea. I think they don't realize that punting, like anything in life, you generally get at what you put in. And all the people I know who make decent money punting, they're the hardest working people I've ever met.
So, Mark, we talked about your beginnings on the race course. That your career sort of did take off full time in gambling, but casinos.
Yeah, I ended up working in casinos. In fact, my first full time job any full time job, it's all been something to do with betting, was I worked for a while for a high street bookmaker in a real rough house part of London when I was 19 years old. And what I wanted to do, I wanted to get to head office. I thought, I don't want to be a betting shop manager. I want to get to head office and, you know, look at compiling the odds or doing something. They looked like there was no way. Everyone I asked, I just ran into brick walls. So someone mentioned to me about going in casinos as a means to travel. So I got a job in a casino in London. Worked there. You're meant to work for a year before you go abroad, but I worked for about 9 months in London and then went abroad and I did, I think, 5-6 month contracts for Royal Caribbean and got to see a load of the world and had a whale of a time. And yeah, then I came home.
Now, I imagine on cruise ships, it's to coin a bookmaker's phrase, money without work, people just on holiday having a bit of fun. But do you get, I suppose most people say it's impossible, but do you get serious punters at casinos in the metropolitan areas or, you know?
Oh, you do. On the cruise ships, you still get your big, it was 95% American punters. You still get your blokes who like to sort of dominate the casino and the craps table and so on. But in London, it was just heavily a lot of Chinese and Middle Eastern punters at the casino betting huge amounts. They take it very seriously. Throwing huge sums of money around in those casinos in London.
But I assume that none of them can win ultimately. There's no way to beat the bank.
Not really, no. You can sort of limit your losses by playing as good a strategy as you can on a game like blackjack or craps. You can get some bets which are 0% takeout if you like on craps. But no, the only people who will be lifetime winners in the casino are people who fit a massive jackpot on the slots and then, you know, haven't got enough years in their life to give it all back.
What about, did you have to keep your eye open for like card counters, that sort of thing?
You did a bit in London, yeah. They just used to say to you that if it looks like someone's counting cards, they just used to try and distract them basically and just start talking to them and try and upset the count. But I never really, I never came across anything really like that. And certainly not that I noticed.
And were there any characters that used to frequent your casinos that were akin to those on a race course?
Yeah, there were. Not as colourful as the race course characters, but there used to be some good ones. There was an old guy in one of the casinos in London in Bayswater, the Golden Horseshoe, called Mr. Lee. And he was a real character. He was a bit of a moneylender, I think. I remember one day walking down Bayswater High Street, Queensway, to go to work, and I looked across at the big restaurant opposite the casino, and it was covered in flowers, bunches of flowers everywhere, and it was called Mr. Lee. I was like, oh, wow, I wonder if that's Mr. Lee. So I saw, you know, Mr. Lee came in 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he always did, sat down, I said, hey, Mr. Lee, is that anything to do with you, that new restaurant? And he just went, yeah, I want it in a game of Mahjong. So fair enough. So they used to gamble all day and all night in the casino. When the casino was shut, they'd all go and gamble Mahjong. It's just a huge part of the culture, and most of the big punters in there are all to do with the Chinese and Asian restaurants in that part of London.
And the cruise ships were that much different because it's mostly Americans.
Mostly Americans and just people out for a good time, really. I think the things I learned really on the cruise ships was, I think there was about 1,500 or 2,000 staff in one of the ships I worked on. And there was about, I think there were 60 odd different nationalities. So I soon learned that everyone's the same. Everyone laughs at the same things. You know, when you're walking along, we used to call it the I-95, which is a highway in America. Like, it would be called the M5 or so, the M1 or something over here. And you'd walk along, it was under the main decks, and you'd be walking back from the bar, and the ship would be swaying. And occasionally, like, everyone would go, you know, you'd see everyone go, and everyone laughs, you know, no matter what nationality you were. If there's a load of people falling over in the corridor, everyone's laughing, and it was just it was a good time and a means to travel for me. I wanted to travel, seemed like a good way to do it, and it was.
So you eventually decided to return to the UK, and am I right in saying your first job was UK betting?
It was. I came back off the ships with absolutely bugger all in my pocket. I definitely went for a good time rather than any sort of saving exercise. One of the lads, who's a good friend of mine now, who I shared a cabin with, he would sort of put away more money than me. And I think when he left after about 4 years, he had deposits down on a couple of houses. And when I left, I think I had about $60 in my pocket and not much else, but I'd had a good time. So anyway, I got home and I decided I wanted to have another go at getting into sort of the back end of the bookmakers. And by then, the online boom had just started. It was 2001. So I thought, yeah, the only way I can really knew how to do it was get the Racing Post every Saturday and just start phoning bookmakers. And I did it for about 6 weeks, I think. I'd get the Racing Post, open it up, right, Sunderland's, get on the phone. Have you got any jobs? No. Okay, next one. Wilson's was one. It was a real old school firm. I'd phone them. In the end, the bloke used to say to me, it's you again. And I'm like, yeah. I said, I'm going to keep phoning because you never know. Someone may leave. Anyway, I'd phone every firm on a Saturday and just say, I've got the experience. I want a job. And then one day, there was a new firm in there. Half a page ad, UK betting. It's like, oh, I've never heard of them. Give them a ring, phone the number. Bloke answers the phone. I said, oh, I'm looking for a job. And the guy said, do you know what a rule four is? I said, yeah, I do know what a rule four is. You know, you and I know it's the deductions taken from a non-runner. And he just said, be here Monday, 9 o'clock. And that was it. Told me the address, Kingly Street, Soho. See you 9 o'clock. Bye. The phone was down. I thought, bloody hell. I thought, that's all right. But it's, you know, it's Saturday morning. So I had to get the train up on Sunday. Bang, knock on the door, tiny little office in Soho. Then, yeah, next thing you know, I was working at UK Betting. And I think there was five of us in total in the whole company at that point.
So that was, they were totally online, or did they take phone calls as well?
No, it was completely online.
So one of the things with the online betting was all of a sudden it became totally blatantly obvious to you who was beating you and who wasn't. Were you surprised or not how many shrewd punters there were out there actually getting a nice few quid at it?
I was, yeah, I was. I was very surprised. And believe me, we attracted every single sharp punter in the country at UK Betting, because we decided that we needed a a unique selling point. So we said what we'd do, we'll price up every race, every day, the night before. So before we left at 5 o'clock in the evening, and it was the sort of thing, you would go home, like things would basically shut down at 5 o'clock. We'd have, it was the start of the online thing. We'd even go out for lunch on a Friday sometimes and close the whole business down. No one could make a deposit, no one could make a withdrawal, as long as you got back before racing. It was all good. So we said, right, we need a unique selling point. We'll price up every race. So we were literally pricing up 30, 40 races sometimes. So you there were times when you'd spend 5 minutes on a race. And it was essentially, it was the Bet365 model of today, but in 2001. So we'd put the prices up to really small limits. Or any winning punter was 25 quid maximum bet. And by the time the actual, the meaty part of the betting arrived, half an hour before the race, we had a really good idea about where the sharp money was going to go. And actually, it was a really profitable strategy. You know, it's one that, as I say, 365 and that do now on a much larger scale. But we made it work for us, and we built a good customer base. And, you know, UK betting ended up, there was five of us working there. Really, I just sort of, so fake it till you make it, I just sort of blagged it, really. I told them I knew all about how to work computers. My first day, I sat down with a lad called Jeremy Barrell, who's one of the top managers of, I think he's in charge of football at BWIN. I sat down next to him and he says to me, open a new window. And I'm sat at the computer and I'm thinking, a window? And I look around. The only window I can see is over the boss's shoulder in the office. And he said to me, are you serious? And I went, yeah. He says, you'll have to help me out here. I said, give us a chance. And fair play, he helped me through, and you sort of muddle through. And that was the way it was done. But by the time I left UK betting, there was hundreds of staff, and we took over Total Bet and Sportal and Sporting Life. And we had an American owner, Eric Semmel, who went round a snap, bought the Sporting Life for £1 and snapped up all these boom and bust online things. And they ended up floating on the stock exchange, and it was a really successful business. And in the end, I think they sold out to Skybet, I think.
Did you ever get to the bottom of some of the shrewdies that were sort of beating you, find out how they were doing it or what their sort of strategy was, or even get to know who they were personally?
Not really. Oh yeah, I knew. I ended up knowing a few of them personally, and you'd see their bets come in. But no, never really got into that sort of reverse engineering thing of sort of, I don't know, guess studying their bets to a huge extent.
Would following them in be a part of your daily routine?
Following them in was definitely a part of the daily routine back then, yeah. It was just, yeah, everyone sort of did it. Everyone had their good marks, and that was all part of the game, yeah.
So why did you leave in the end?
I left in the end, I think Eric, who owned the place, he was a little American, big dog we used to call him. He wasn't a dog and he wasn't big, but he thought he knew everything. And he was just driving me mad. You know, he'd come and sit in the trade room, and you know, we might have laid one down the book from 8-1 down to 6-4. We're trying to lay more at 6-4 to sort of average it out and actually do a bit of bookmaking. And he's screaming at us to back it all back at 6-4, and it just got a bit much. And in the end, an Aussie firm set up, funnily enough. Centrebet came over with a Super Odds arm, which was going to be their UK business. And they came in all guns blazing. I remember, I think it was York was their first meeting, and they decided to come over and just put up their own prices. So they went 16-1, which was, I think it was 16-1, which was 7-2 best price in the Pricewise box on their advert. And they went 7-2 something, which was 13-8. Anyway, everyone was on. They both won. And then next week they just did the same. So I thought, I quite liked the fact, I liked their intent, even if it was a bit naive. So I wrote to the owner of Centre Bet, Con Cafetaris, who's a like legendary bookmaker over here. I didn't know that at the time. And just said, you know, I like what you're doing, blah, 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 but you can't do it. You know, you can't do it. You're going to have to get wise about how it works over here. You're going to have to get a couple of tissues. And if, you know, if the two tissues say that it's 11 to 2, then you maybe want to be going 13 to 2 or 7, but you don't want to be going 14 to 1 because you're just sort of going to get your trousers taken down. And they made me a good offer to go and be their sort of racing manager. So I took that job, and I was there for a little while, not long. I was there for about a year before I left to go to the jockey club.
Okay, so you mentioned there that a jockey club security, so you went from being a bookie to I suppose it's still looking after the bookie's interest, really. So how did that job come about, and what did it entail?
Yeah, that job came about, actually. I didn't see the ad in the Racing Post. My dad saw the ad, and dad phoned me up and said there was a job here that might suit you. And it was at the Jockey Club as the sort of first betting analyst, betting investigator, betting expert to be part of their new security and intelligence unit, which was being set up by Paul Scottney. I think Paul Scottney joined in 2003. I ended up getting that job after a long and arduous recruitment process. And I started in 2004, and when I got to the intelligence unit there, I think there was only five of us in the actual office, you know, away from your obviously just stable inspectors and stuff like that in the field. But Paul Scottney had rightly recognised that it might be handy for the jockey club to have someone who knew the first thing about racing and betting. So that turned out to be me. And then we took on other people and grew. And by the time I left, it was a fully functioning sort of gold standard worldwide sport intelligence unit.
Okay, so this was the exchanges are coming to being by this point. Was a lot of your investigation around them?
Yeah, we based almost all of our betting related investigations through the exchanges. Not simply because there was a lot of skullduggery going on the exchanges, but the exchanges were just extremely transparent and open with us. We worked really closely with the Betfair guys and mainly Betfair, but BetDaq to a lesser degree, and in contact with them on a daily basis. And they would do their own investigations, we would do ours, and there was plenty going on. I think when Betfair started in 2001, whenever it was, I think what had happened is some of the less desirable owners, trainers, jockeys, whatever, must have laid a few on there, and then nothing happened because, you know, to be honest, no one was watching at Betfair, but not watching at the jockey club. And that was, you know, one of the reasons why they had to set up a fully functioning intelligence unit. So when I got there, it was I didn't say it was like the Wild West, but there was plenty going on, and there was plenty had gone on for the previous couple of years. So we had lots of jobs, lots of active cases, and yeah, by the time I left 6 years later, it was a different beast. I think we pretty much got everyone who we thought we should, dozens of trainers and jockeys, owners. I think they just got slack and thought that no one was ever going to tap them on the shoulder, but the tap eventually came.
Were you shocked or pleasantly surprised by, in inverted commas, how bent the game actually was?
I wasn't shocked, and it was still a small percentage of races. Even at its worst, it was still small. But I wasn't shocked because I'd seen a few races. I remember watching the Gary Carter race when he stopped Dodona, horse called Dodona, when I was at UK betting. I remember it was a terrible result for us. And I remember throwing my pen against the TV or something, thinking, you bent this and that. And I'd seen a few races after that. So I wasn't completely shocked, but I was there, you know, we were opening up these cases, and then you were looking back through, you'd obviously see one race. So there was your sort of, there's your one race, there's your sort of smoking gun, and then you'd find that race, and then you'd get all the different accounts in, and then look back at the previous, and you'd see patterns of all the races that had gone on previously. So that's what we were doing. We would see a race that we didn't like, match up the bet into the ride or whatever, analyze the bets, analyze the accounts and the linked accounts, and then sort of work backwards, because you'd find a pattern of a jockey or a trainer or whatever, because to be honest, they weren't sophisticated betting people, the people who were who were doing this sort of thing.
Okay, so how many people do you reckon were brought to book and that you could actually prove a case against? And were there any high profile sort of names that people might know?
Well, as I said, we got everyone who we wanted to get. We got everyone we thought the evidence was really strong. You know, you had Dean McEwen's and Blockley's and Dean Myrna's and that sort of ilk. Wherever, you know, a lot of people in the industry knew that these people were up to no good. So we think we got mainly the sort of bad apples. Probably the highest profile case, which turned into a bit of a saga, was the Harry Finlay case. So we got a call from Betfair to say Harry had laid one of his own horses, which was obviously a breach of the rules. And as it happened, they just brought in a new rule to say, brought up the minimum limits of penalties, the minimum penalties. So it had gone from a fine, I think, just before to, I think, 6 months ban was the minimum. So Harry, even though it was a technicality, really a technicality, he laid Gullible Gordon, which was one of his horses, the Paul Nichols horse, I think he laid it for 400 or 800 or something, but then had 20 grand on it, you know. So he didn't profit from the race, but he had broken the rule. So really, a fine would have been a fine or a telling off, a ticking off would have been more appropriate then for him, because he had 50, 60 horses in training, I think. So it turned into an absolute saga. And I felt for him, really. You know, I wasn't drawn to Harry's TV personality particularly. You know, I'd maybe turn the sound down when Harry came on shouting, but when I met him, we sort of hit it off, you know, and we sort of got a bit of a friendship, even though I was investigating him. It was a very weird time. It was quite odd, because we were investigating him, but he was still phoning me all the time because he knew I was sort of on his side. And it went on and on and on. It was quite strange, but in the end, I think he got his ban turned over.
Now, on a lighter note, you're telling me a story when we were sort of talking about doing this, that you backed Yates to try and pay for your wedding, and that was a bit of an awkward situation where you couldn't cheer. What was going on there?
I did. Well, it was a bit like that. I remember being at Royal Ascot when Yates won its first Ascot Gold Cup, and I think I was there with my wife. My memory may be playing tricks on me, but I'm sure I turned around to my wife, my girlfriend at the time, saying, "If this goes to the Melbourne Cup, this could pay for the wedding." Like, I was convinced this horse is the best stare I've ever seen. I still think it is, but maybe I'm deluded. So I just started chipping away. So that would have been in June. First Tuesday of November would be the Melbourne Cup, and the plan was to come over for the Melbourne Cup. My dad would be there because he'd be coming over for my wedding, have a couple of weeks in Australia, then get married in Australia, come home. So I chipped away, tennis here, scores here, chipping away at Yates. Biggest bet I've ever had on a horse before or since. Still having more on it as they were going in the barriers. Like, we'd been there about 5 hours. Racing starts at 9 o'clock in the morning on Melbourne Cup day. So I was pretty well lubricated, having more and more on. Said to my dad, "Oh, we should have a trifecta as well." I said, you pick three, I'll pick three, we'll do six. Never had a trifecta bet in my life. Okay, yeah, we'll just have like what we'd call a combination tricast, but a box trifecta, what we'd call it here. Dad picked three. He said, I'll have the two Japanese horses. He says, they look literally, I remember his words, he said, they look like they're bursting out of their skin. And he picked another one, I picked three. Anyway, I'm still backing Yates. So I'll go and watch Yates. My boss, Paul Scottney, was there. He says, come and watch the Melbourne Cup with me. We'll go with like one of the heads of security of Racing Victoria. So we watched it outside the weighing room, and I'm trying to keep a lid on the fact that I've backed Kieran Fallon, who's sort of enemy number one in the intelligence unit where I worked. You know, his court case was just coming up in the Old Bailey, and he wasn't the most sort of popular bloke. So I was trying to keep it together. And as they come out, Yates took it up about 600 out, and I'm going, go on, Kieran, go on. Scottney's looking at me like, what are you doing? I'm here with the top boy from Racing Victoria, and you're screaming for the arch villain. And I just couldn't help myself screaming. Anyway, it got beat. Got beat fair and square. I thought for years and years that it was given a bad ride, but I watched it again the other day, and I think it was pretty fair and square. But so anyway, I went, okay, so go back to see my dad. Dad's like, ah, shame about Yates. He says, anyway, we got the trifecta up. I said, did we? And yeah, you got a trifecta up. He says, we've got plenty of Japanese horses finished first and second. We got the bottom weight snuck in. I thought, oh, that's all right. So I got the ticket, went up to, I'm not going to pay for the wedding with back in Yates, but might pay the bar bill with a trifecta. Go to collect the hand me ticket over. The woman's like, no, there's no return on that. So what are you talking about? So there's no return on that. So I picked six horses. She says, well, you've only given me five. And what I'd done, I'd gone up with a race card, and because the bottom weight was the one that finished third, it was about four pages over, number 23. And I was pissed by that time, and I forgot to call it. So a lot did me money there as well. That's life.
Okay, Mark, then. So you set your business up in Australia in 2010. The catalyst for that was surprisingly not horse racing, but tennis.
Yeah, it kind of was in a way. I always knew, I knew that myself and my girlfriend at the time, she was Australian. She'd been in London 15 years. She wanted to move back to Australia. So I was keen anyway. I said, so yeah, we'll move. And hadn't really thought what I would do. Probably maybe go to Melbourne, get a job with Racing Victoria or something like that. But then one day, we were sat in the office at British Horse Racing, and I saw a tennis match going on. It was all over the Betfair Forum, which was like the, you know, the Twitter of its time. And everyone's talking about this tennis match with just crazy betting patterns, in play betting patterns. Nikolai Davidenko of Russia against Martin Vaseo Aguayo from Argentina. And Davidenko was like number five in the world. Vaseo Aguayo was top 100, I think, or maybe outside the top 100. And Davidenko should have been about five on. He won the first set, and he'd gone from five on to even money after winning the first set. So everyone was screaming about it. You know, you couldn't have had a bigger red flag. So we contacted Betfair just to give them the heads up, which is what we'd do. Betfair were already all over it. Betfair told the tennis authorities, the ATP, it was an ATP event in Sopot in Poland. Davidenko was the defending champion. Anyway, he retired shortly after. His price, the further he got in front, the bigger his price got. It was ridiculous. So Betfair reported it to the ATP. The ATP basically said to them, We haven't got a clue. We don't know how to investigate this sort of stuff. What should we do? They said, well, why don't you go to see if British Horse Racing will help you out with it? So I ended up doing just a consultancy for the ATP, taking charge of all the betting investigations from all the matches that came out of that investigation. So from that one match, it just absolutely blossomed. You investigate the one match, and then obviously you go back and check the different bets and the different matches, and it was clear that tennis had a massive problem. So we investigated it. We ended up handing it all over, handing all our evidence over to the guy who was about to set up the new tennis integrity unit. And we handed it over. Not a lot came of it, and it all blew up in their face sort of a few years later with a BuzzFeed and BBC investigation. And I think they're more on top of it now, but it was certainly it was a bit of a missed opportunity from them. But from that, I remember at that time going for a drink in the old Coach and Horses in Soho, the old Geoffrey Barnard pub. And actually with good friend of mine who was the guy who employed me at UK Betting, the old what's the rule, you know, do you know what a rule four is, J.R. Doherty. So we're just chatting away. I'm telling him about this tennis investigation, and we just started thinking maybe there's a there's a gap in the market for, if tennis don't know how to investigate this stuff, maybe there's a gap in the market for a consultancy. And sort of GSI was born really out of that conversation in the Coach and Horses. So JR, he set up the business with me. He's my business partner. He's still my business partner now. We've been involved pretty much every business I've been involved in, bar a couple of, has been me and JR. So yeah, GSI was born then really. That was 2008. And I didn't leave the BHA till October 2010. So as soon as I left, I set up GSI.
Okay, and you actually had to go betting for a living for a while.
Only when I got to Australia. We had a two-year-old son and a baby just about to be born. I was making contacts and sort of working on GSI. But while I was working at British Horse Racing, we weren't allowed to bet at British Horse Racing on UK Racing. So I used to do a lot of sort of paper trading and to keep my eye on pricing races and whatever. And, you know, as well as doing my brains on the Melbourne Cup and the Arc and every other race where I could actually was allowed to have a bet. But I'd noticed a sort of a trend in the markets where I thought this will probably apply to Australia, where it was basically just, there was no form involved. It was all to do with market monitoring and slow moving markets and slow to react bookmakers. So it is a bit of a cautionary tale. I started at the start of 2011. We arrived in Australia in November 2010. So around January 2011, when we got our own place here, I started with not a massive bank, but cracked on anyway, working mainly Wednesdays and Saturdays, which were the metro meetings. And it just took off. It was amazing. It's a cautionary tale because it shows you that you need to do everything right to make it pay as sort of a professional punter, if you like, or someone who's trying to bet, you know, to pay the mortgage or pay the rent. And I was looking back at my spreadsheet the other day, 2011, something like 3,800 or something bets, winning 12.5% on turnover. It was almost level stakes, really half a unit, one unit, but almost all one unit bets. And I, at the end of the year, I was 440 summit units in profit. And I went skint because, my bank management just wasn't good enough. So what happened is the first 7 months were so smooth. The first 7 months I was winning 24% on turnover. My best month was 34%. And it was so steady. It was so steady. But what I was doing, rather than sort of putting that money away, waiting for, knowing that the bad times are around the corner, because they always are, as you know, the losing run is coming, whether you like it or not. I just, was paying for everything. Bills had to be paid. It was our only source of income. My wife was heavily pregnant. So it went great for 7 months. Everything was honky-dory. And then for the next 4 months, it just completely plateaued. And my worst month in those 11 months was losing 4%. My second worst month was winning 4%. And because my sort of bank management was so poor, I in the end had to give up. After 11 months, I looked at my bank and I was just like, it's just, there's no point. It's so small. There's no point doing it. As it happened, it coincided with getting a few contracts for GSI, and GSI started to take off. So it made sense to jack it in anyway. But I still look at that spreadsheet sometimes and just think that would have been, on pure figures, my best year's punting ever. and I still managed to go skint.
Would there be many full-time backers in Australia?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. It's a huge punting country, Australia. I think per capita they spend more money than anyone else on the punt. And it's not looked down on as really, a little bit more these days, but not really looked down on as a bad thing. And I'm sure percentage-wise there's an equal amount of professional punters over here as there is in the UK.
Are there any high-profile names that would be known, like, you know, the ones over here?
Yeah, there are. But I don't really know many of those guys, you know. But there's plenty of people making a few quid for sure. Like for one thing, we have minimum bet limits here, which certainly makes it easier for your, not necessarily making it easier for your high staking punters, but for your sort of small and medium sized professional punters who are grinding it out to be able to get on to win. You can get on to win $2,000 to win or 800 to place at 9 o'clock on all gallops. And I think half that or a quarter of that on harness and greyhounds, and all the stakes are getting involved. So for people who want to put the hours in and grind it out, I think that is a bit of a boon over here.
Okay, do you still bet yourself?
I haven't had a bet on racing in a while. I mean, the thing is, betting with me, I'm either all in or I'm all out. I'm either putting the hours in and doing the research and trying to do it properly, or I'm just not having a bet at all. So the last couple of years, I've only been betting on golf. So that's another thing that I do with JR, my business partner. We go halves in on golf, and it stops me. It's good. I think it's good to go in with someone else because I'm quite risk averse. So if we've got a golfer winning us fortunes and he's three clear, six holes to play, if it's just down to me, I'll lay and I'll start hedging. You know, that sort of risk averse bookmaker's personality that I've got. Whereas if I'm in 50-50 with someone else like JR, I'd send him a message, do you reckon we should lay this? And he's like, no, or we'll agree to lay it. But it's, I think betting with someone else stops you. Well, you don't want to mess around with someone else's money.
GSI is still going strong after 10 years. Does that suggest that's bad news for sport and corruption in it or not?
No, I don't think so. I think it really indicates that there is just a need for independent integrity monitors. And every sport, I think, realises this. A lot of the sports have now gone in-house and so on. But there's always going to be incidents of match fixing and so on. I think Australia is a very clean sporting environment. And, I think the UK is too. I think doping is a big thing. Bigger thing than sort of betting integrity, really, as far as a problem with it. More sort of the cheating to win rather than the hooking one up to lose. I think the fact that we're still around doesn't reflect badly on sports. I think sports have just got a bit more wised up, and I think even the smaller sports now realise that they do need a bit of help.
So finally, what's next on the horizon? Is GSI going to carry on, or is there something else you've got planned?
We'll carry on as long as people want us. We've got to the sort of point where we don't chase work. We haven't chased work for a few years, but our current clients, we carry on doing what we do, and people know where we are. We're sort of the go-to people if the police force have got someone claiming that they've won a load of money through betting. We get most of those jobs to analyse the accounts. We've analysed thousands of accounts, so we can generally go in and see where they've made slip-ups. And we've actually had some really good success of getting some high-profile cases that were about to go to court, where the guy who said he's won these millions punting, the police have shown the punter our work. And the punters just held their hands up and said, yeah, it was, I made it up or whatever. So we'll carry on the horizon. I've got a just came off a call before this call, actually, for an hour about a new startup I've got, just about to start. I can't say too much about it, but hopefully in a couple of years I'll be able to tell you what a success it's been, and a couple of other things, cricket betting product I've been working on. So there's always something on the go. I've always got something on the go, and so far, at least, you know, managed to pay the mortgage and enjoy the lifestyle here, so it's not too bad.
So Australia is going to be home. You're not going to retire to a few pitches at Luke Nabbit in Exeter?
Well, you never know, Simon. Never say never. Never say never. I do like a point to point.
Brilliant. Well, it's been lovely talking to you, Mark, catching up. And thanks for giving us your time, and good luck with the new project. And thank you.
Thanks, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
New Betting People interviews are published every week at Star Sports. Exclusive interviews with the key people from the world of sports betting. Check out our full library of interviews at starsportsbet.co.uk. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.